Ms. Barker, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, you can go ahead and proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Barker from Olson, Cannon, Gormley, and Stabersky, and I represent petitioners in this case. The petitioners are the Clark County School District and three of its elementary school administrators. In November of 2016, the petitioners notified the underlying plaintiff's adult plaintiff mother that her five-year-old son had been involved in some horseplay in the bathrooms at school. He was a kindergartner. The horseplay involved her son and several other kindergarten boys. Following day, the plaintiff notified the school district that she believed her son had been sexually assaulted in the course of that horseplay. That was November of 2016. In May of 2022, the plaintiff filed suit in district court. In that suit, she alleges that she and her minor son sustained damages, injury as a result of negligence by the petitioners. Petitioners filed a motion to dismiss the claims by the adult plaintiff mother. It is important that the court understand petitioners are not challenging whether or not the claims were timely brought on behalf of the minor. This issue is whether or not the claims were timely brought on behalf of the petitioner parent or the plaintiff parent in the underlying suit. The district court denied the motion to dismiss, applying NRS 11.215. The motion was premised on the complaint having been filed 3.5 years after the 2-year statute of limitations applicable to mom's own personal injury claims. The court applied NRS 11.215 to extend and eliminate that statute of limitations. NRS 11.215 lifts the statute of limitations for a claim brought by an adult plaintiff who was the victim as a minor of sexual assault. And it specifically eliminates that claim or allows the statute of limitations to be lifted as to a claim against a perpetrator or person convicted of the sexual abuse of that person. Judge Denton's rationale in lifting that statute of limitations was that the opening sentence of NRS 11.215 is vague, and it says that it applies to, quote, an action to recover damages for injury to a person arising from sex abuse or exploitation of the plaintiff. And there's an ambiguity as to whether or not the person it applies to has to be the plaintiff. The district court did not find ambiguity as to the second portion of that introduction section, which says that it allows for an action against an alleged perpetrator or person convicted of the sex abuse. So that leaves this court with three questions on this petition, which follow the denial of the motion to dismiss. The first one is whether or not the school district petitioners are an intended target of the statute. Do they fall within the limited category of defendants for whom there is no longer a limitation period? The second question for the court is whether or not the underlying adult plaintiff mother falls into the category of persons to be benefited by being allowed to bring an action without a limitations period. So I'd like to address the first question first. Because it's the cleanest. There are no allegations in the complaint that any school district employee participated in or encouraged any sexual assault between the five-year-old boys at issue. The allegations are negligence allegations asserting that the school district failed to properly supervise, properly train. There is no allegation of any intent by the school district that would rise to the level that would place it in the category of a perpetrator and clearly not a person convicted of having committed abuse on a child. Because the school district does not fall in that limited category of defendant, this action cannot go forward by the mother against the school district. In their answering papers in the petition, The plaintiff talks about the school district petitioners being other potentially responsible parties, other potentially liable parties. There's no allegation that they are a perpetrator in this case.
And I appreciate the underlying arguments that you're making, but I'm trying to get over the preliminary hurdle of whether or not we should entertain this writ at this point. There does seem to be an adequate and speedy legal remedy. I don't believe you're seeking dismissal on behalf of the minor, and so you're going to have to litigate it anyway. You have a speedy, you know, you're going to go to trial, and that usually constitutes an adequate and speedy legal remedy. Why should we entertain this writ at this point?
Okay, the argument I've just made answers that question, I believe, Justice Lee. The issue is whether or not this claim is viable. And by denying the motion to dismiss, and the statute of limitations is appropriately raised as part of that motion to dismiss, petitioners are now going to be required to defend against a claim that isn't legally viable in the first place as defined by this statute. And although I understand we could go to trial, we could litigate this case, we could do it as part of the claim brought by the minor child, the issue arguably is broader. If we didn't have the claim of the minor child, should this be allowed to go forward? Should a defendant who is not targeted by this eliminated limitations period be required to litigate a case? Is that really speedy or adequate remedy? And it is our position that it is not.
Well, under your argument, it really would apply to both the mother and the child if the focus is on perpetrator in terms of the claims in this particular litigation.
Correct. The child, however...
I know the child's claims aren't at issue here.
Right. And I anticipated that question, Your Honor. That the child's claim as against someone who is not a perpetrator is covered statutorily by a couple of other provisions in the statute. One, he has until he's 18 or 2 years past the time he's 18. The issue, as we get to the question of whether or not the plaintiff falls in that category of beneficiaries, if you look to the statutory history, this statute was created in 1991 after the Supreme Court's decision in Peterson in 1990. And the Peterson Court specifically... That case, the Peterson case, arose because an adult plaintiff discovered in therapy that he had been abused as a child, and he filed suit against the perpetrator of that abuse. The Supreme Court determined that there was no specific limitation period applicable to that suit. The question being, was it timely filed? And so the court allowed the discovery provision of NRS 11.190 to extend 2 years to that plaintiff beyond the date the plaintiff had the recurring memory, recalled the abuse as a child to file that suit. That same analysis would apply in with regard to the minor plaintiff in the circumstance posed, Justice Herndon. If in fact the minor plaintiff doesn't discover, doesn't recall that he's been abused until after he's past the age of majority, he would still have 2 years from the date of that recollection to bring suit against a party who was not the perpetrator. The statute of limitations was lifted solely as to suits against the perpetrator. When you look at the original version of this statute was enacted in 1991. And then over a period of several years, the court went back and revisited, made the limitation period longer, brought in additional causes of action under it. In 2021, the court or the legislature did kind of an extraordinary thing and lifted the statute of limitations in its entirety. And if you look to the language created in 1991, that language then added a narrower category of defendants. This narrow category of defendants applicable to the statute didn't exist before 2021. So the legislature, when they decide we're not going to have a statute of limitations, lifted that statute only as to perpetrators or persons convicted of the crime. It narrowed the category of people that the suit could be filed concerning.
So without those other statutes that you referenced that saves dismissal from the minor, if this were the only statute that referenced perpetrators as it pertains to an injury to a person, Would you be standing here today seeking dismissal for the minor as well, based on the definition of perpetrator? Because I think what you're saying is that CCSD and the two administrators are not perpetrators within the meaning of the statute as it pertains to the mom, correct?
Correct.
But are you saying that it does fit statutorily as it pertains to the minor?
No, because the CCSD defendants still are not perpetrators, and that lifted statutory period is specific as to perpetrators.
Okay, but the reason why you're not seeking dismissal then is because there's other statutory provisions that would still keep this case on.
Correct. Okay. The victim remains a minor. He's not yet turned 18. We are not at a point in the case where we have any understanding as to his recall of the events. Mm-hmm. But we understand he's been in counseling, so he knows of the events at issue.
So one thing that was confusing to me, and the record didn't really clear it up, so if there's anything you all can offer, please do. The judge kind of inviting summary judgment later on this issue is confusing because it seems to be a legal issue. I'm not sure what discovery would occur that would allow the judge to revisit the issue of whether the mom can take advantage of this statute or not.
I was not either, Your Honor. In our perception, this is exactly a legal issue. Entirely that school district defendants are not part of that specific category of defendants, and the plaintiff isn't the intended beneficiary.
Okay. Is there any more clear guidance on what constitutes a perpetrator? Could it be that the school, by either facilitating or willfully ignoring the incident, in fact, could be a perpetrator within the definition of the statute?
I looked for that, Your Honor, and I couldn't find any Nevada definition or explanation of what that perpetrator might be. As I looked to standard Black's Dictionary, Oxford Dictionary definitions, because that's where we default, those definitions refer to persons who actually commit a crime, persons who commit a harmful act, a person who carries out a harmful, illegal, or immoral act. In the facts of this case, as pled in the complaint, the school district defendants don't fall into that category.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Morris?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Justices. Christian Morris for the plaintiffs in this case. I think that a point that was very on the crux of this is that it would not change the posture of this case for having a derivative claim for the mother. All of the allegations made by the minor would go through the discovery process. I don't know exactly what Judge Denton was saying when he said maybe right for summary judgment, but we haven't even begun discovery in this case. The allegations are very clear that this had been going on for months. It was only discovered by a substitute teacher. And so we really have to look at what was going on in the school system that allowed for this to occur when teachers are responsible for the children in their care. And what we have here is simply a derivative claim where you look at, of course, a parent would rather have this happen to them than their own child. And there will be suffering as a result. If you look at the plain language of the statute, which is an action to recover damages for an injury to a person arising from the sexual abuse or sexual exploitation of the plaintiff, it calls for and allows for derivative claims. It does not limit it to the victims. And in this case, she had her own claim. She has anxiety. She's had panic attacks. She's had to have treatment for what happened to her 5-year-old son.
But is CCSD and the two administrators, are they the actual perpetrators of the crime?
And I think that that's an excellent question. We have not been able to get into discovery. Of course, in the allegations, we say that they act in concert and agencies and all of the language we put there in good faith because we haven't been able to discover what was going on in the school to allow this to occur. We're not saying that they actually committed the act. However, we should be allowed to discover it. And if you look at what the purpose of the statute is, it's for maximum justice in these very complex cases. And so where we have a situation where we have not been allowed to delve into it, we're not saying that the teacher did it, but it certainly was allowed to occur and continue to occur.
And in your mind, that's enough for a definition of a perpetrator. They don't have to physically commit the act, but they, if they're collusive or they're willfully blind or whatever, then they could fit within the statutory definition of perpetrator.
I don't know that we have a good statutory definition of perpetrator for this point, but that's where I think we need to look at what was the intent behind this. Because if someone knows of it and allows it to continue on, does that just mean the statute of limitations runs for them? They knew it was occurring, they're allowing it to continue to occur, the child goes through the abuse and they're just, quote, off the hook. And that's where I think we have to look at it. What's the point of this statute? It's allow for children of sexual abuse and people who are injured as a result to recover with no statute of limitations. And so that's where I think it's an evolving concept, because what we have here is an evolution of the recognition that this is a very serious issue, that there was a limitation. It's been lifted. It's been extended. And now it is gone for people who are injured as a result. I think that's what we're
It's Perry, Gary, and Carson City again. In that regard, and you're indicating your understanding of injury to a person creates an ambiguity, and Judge Denton found that it was an ambiguous provision, and he didn't. Where did his analysis go beyond that? Did he go in and analyze the legislative history, as you would do as part of statutory construction? And it doesn't look like you came back with anything. You didn't really analyze the legislative history in this case. Your colleague on the other side did, in fact, and cited to how this kind of developed with Peterson versus Broome, and actually indicated that adult survivors of child sexual abuse present unique circumstances and injuries that don't readily conform to the statute of limitations. That seems to be what drove this, which doesn't apply to your client, JD.
So I don't believe that it was fully ferreted out. I think you're correct in the legislative history. However, we know about the legislative intent behind it to allow for injury to people as a result of sexual abuse, and derivative claims are always part of that. But I think if you look at what the intent is, so if a parent has a derivative claim of a minor who has been sexually abused, in order to preserve that claim, they would have to file within their statute of limitations against the actors who are not the perpetrators, but maybe potentially allowed for it, litigate those exact same facts and the same harms in a court of law until the minor maybe is an adult and or feeling capable enough to bring that claim if that's the situation, and then re-litigate it. So because it's a derivative claim and the language of the statute is an action for recovery for damages for the injury to a person, and we're well aware that that can have derivative claims to it, it's intended for those to be brought together. And so if you apply it in the way in which the Clark County School District wants it to, it would be in order for the parent to preserve this claim, which is a very valid and legitimate claim, they would have to expose the minor to having to go through these facts in the same exact court with the same exact harms and then potentially file it when the minor is ready. And that's why the issue is looking at the practicality of this, because the minor's claim remains and all of the claims in this case remain. It's a matter of the litigation of the derivative claim of the mother.
Okay. Yeah, and so your point is bringing it within her period of time, statute of limitations, would just cause the minor to incur additional trauma and...
Exactly, and it would be an unjust result to someone who has been harmed by the sexual abuse of their child, because then they are either making a choice that they have to go do this and or not wait until their child is ready to face these very difficult, trying issues, of which many of them take a very long time to come to terms with it. They don't have to be 18, but they have to be ready to be able to handle this and to go through it. And so that makes an unjust result that the person who's also injured doesn't have the ability to bring the claim with the underlying claim.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Herndon, I don't know if I cut you off with the question that you had.
You kind of got into it with Justice Perry's question. It's okay. Thank you.
I think that the last point I would like to make, because I do have a few minutes left, but I don't want to drag this out, is that it really does have to be looked at as to what then would occur if we applied the law in which the defense wants it applied. Because that would mean that a parent could never bring a claim unless they did it before their child was ready, before they were able to come to terms with it, before they could actually bring this forward. And the fact is this is, in obviously plaintiff's opinion, premature, because we do have the same facts. They are all going to be brought out into light, and potentially there will be additional information that maybe that's what Judge Denton was alluding to, as to what the school did or knew to allow this to go on for months. And maybe that would and then come to light as to what a true perpetrator means. It is a conspirator. Is it someone who has knowledge and allows it to happen? And we know that they do have the obligations in loco parentis to take care of these children when they're on their property. Thank you, unless there's any other questions.
Any further questions, Justice Trager?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
Your Honors, I think the argument that not applying this to a parent and requiring the parent to file suit within the statute of limitations applicable under Section 11.190 somehow creates additional trauma to the child is misleading. The purpose of lifting the statute of limitations was to address those cases in which a person had been victimized as a child and suppressed a memory. They didn't know it had happened. There wasn't notice to them it occurred. And so you need to allow time for that memory to recover. We don't have that circumstance here. We have a mother who knew of the events that she believes constituted some form of sexual assault at or about the time those events occurred. There is no reason that when she files claim timely, she cannot also file claim on behalf of the child timely, so that you don't subject the child to two separate series of litigation. It all happens at once, and that is typically, frankly, how you see it done. The parent files on behalf of themselves and on behalf of the child within the applicably appropriate statute of limitations. So this argument that this is somehow going to cause additional trauma to the child is frankly without support, and frankly without support in the legislative history. The intent was to deal with suppressed memory.
Was there any explanation as to why there was a 6-year gap between the time that the incident occurred and the bringing of the lawsuit?
That explanation has never been provided to us. Okay. So I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Sorry, didn't interrupt.
That's fine. Again, the focus really, I think, for the court is twofold here. Who is the intended group of beneficiaries of this lifted statute, and who is the intended group of persons who are targeted by the statute? And as amended in 2021, the targeted group are perpetrators of the crime. And there are no allegations here that the school district was somehow a perpetrator involved in this crime. The allegations are failure to supervise, failure to train. Any other questions?
Justice Perriger, any further questions?
Nope, I'm good.
Oh, sorry. I do have just one quick question. So what about this notion, if they were willfully blind or failed to act, could they then fall within the category of a perpetrator? Would there be value in ferreting out the record in that way and allowing the case to go forward to figure out the level of complicity, if any?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. And in part, again, the full language of the statute references an alleged perpetrator or person convicted of a crime. There is nothing here alleged or that is going to be discovered or that plaintiffs are even after that would make the school district part of the crime. Remember, we are talking about 5-year-old kindergarten boys in the bathroom. School district's not in there. We don't have an employee in there. And the question is supervision of those children.
Gotcha. Understood. Thank you, Counsel.
All right.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both very much. Terrific briefs, great arguments. I appreciate your time today, and the matter will stand submitted.